A hollowing out of the State Department under President Trump is creating concerns at home and abroad.
I think it's fair to say that if you were a foreign adversary, you could not do more damage to America's diplomatic capability than what has been done in the last couple of years.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 21st, we'll explore the consequences of low morale among U.S. diplomats and civil servants. Also on the show, teenagers should be getting more than 8 hours of sleep.
Insufficient sleep is linked to poor academic performance, lower performance on standardized tests, and also other issues related to school success.
And a new movie reminds viewers why the 1970s were an essential moment for Black filmmaking.
As a person of color, we didn't view that era to be exploitive at all. If anything, it was like a resurgence, or not even a resurgence, a birth of entertainment that was done by us, for us.
But we start with the State Department. Let's get going.
My view is that each of us has a solemn responsibility to defend the Constitution and to speak the truth. I hope those officers who go to Capitol Hill will speak truthfully, that they'll speak completely.
As impeachment proceedings move ahead in Congress, the Trump administration's strategy of stonewalling House Democrats is running into a problem of its own making: low morale within the halls of the State Department. Across Washington, D.C., civil servants are meeting in secret, downloading encrypted apps to communicate with each other, and even ducking into bathrooms in order to speak openly. Many of them echoing the same concerns of ousted former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, who told Congress earlier this month that, quote, "Today we see the State Department attacked and hollowed out from within." Other high-ranking members of the diplomatic corps have come forward with their own concerns. On Sunday, George Stephanopoulos spoke to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on ABC and asked him about a recent op-ed written by Bill Burns, a veteran diplomat and former Deputy Secretary of State who worked under both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Here's how he described what you allowed with Ambassador Yovanovitch. Secretary Pompeo allowed specious opposition research about Yovanovitch to circulate around the department and sat on his hands as Trump slandered Yovanovitch on the infamous call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and warned ominously that she's going to, quote, go through some things. Your response?
That's crazy. I think Bill Burns must be auditioning to be Elizabeth Warren's Secretary of State.
On Friday, the State Department weighed in on the ongoing crisis in northern Syria. In a memo sent to American embassies around the world, President Trump's decision to abandon the U.S. Kurdish allies was described as, quote, severely undermining counter-ISIS efforts, endangering innocent civilians, and threatening peace, security, and stability in the region. A far different message than the rosy picture described just a day before at a rally in Dallas.
And we went there, and we said, we want to pause. And the Kurds have been terrific. They're going to move back a little bit. We're going to keep ISIS all nice and locked up.
These breakdowns in communication and confusion over messaging highlight what many diplomats have warned would be the consequences of a State Department hollowed out under Donald Trump. And the institutional decay could outlast his presidency, hurting America's ability to conduct foreign policy for decades. I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. For more, I'm joined by former Ambassador Reuben E. Brigady. He's dean at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University and former U.S. representative to the African Union. Ambassador Brigady, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what effect all of this that we just described is having on civil servants, particularly if they're being labeled by members of the Trump administration as partisan. And I want to go back there to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's comments that Bill Burns, for example, is, quote, auditioning to be Elizabeth Warren's Secretary of State.
Well, gosh, there's so much to say there. I mean, first of all, Ambassador William Burns is one of America's greatest ambassadors and is a true national asset. I had the pleasure of working with him when I was at the State Department. I hosted him at the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and he is a true professional and true gentleman. So Secretary Pompeo's slander is really most unfortunate. Now, let me also say that when we're talking about morale within the State Department, we're not simply talking about, you know, the bruised feelings of cosseted diplomats. What we're really talking about is whether or not our nation's professional diplomatic service feels as if they are rendering service to superiors who also share their commitment to the Constitution and share a commitment to America's interests. And I think it's fair to say that if you were a foreign adversary, you could not do more damage to America's diplomatic capability than what has been done in the last couple of years, starting with the very capricious cuts, some 30%, both in budget and personnel, that were sought to be enacted by Secretary Pompeo's predecessor, former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. But also, quite frankly, you really cannot underestimate the chilling effect that the way in which Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, former ambassador to the Ukraine, the way in which she was treated by the president and how she was not defended by the Secretary of State, what a chilling effect that has had to America's diplomats that are serving all over the world, who quite frankly feel that they are not working for an administration that will support them when they are doing very difficult things on behalf of the national interest all around the world.
Ambassador Brigitte, given everything that you just outlined, would you say that the State Department is in crisis?
I'd say it's very close to it. You know, my office as dean of the Elliott School is literally across the street from the State Department. And my personal office has become something of a speakeasy for State Department personnel, both very junior, in some cases very senior, who'll come over, have a cup of coffee, close the door. Broadly speaking, amongst our most senior diplomats, which you often find, are people that have rendered, you know, decades of service, that have unbelievable expertise in very challenging parts of the world, and in many cases are making the decision that they cannot continue to work for such capricious leadership and then decide to leave precipitously, depriving our country of their great expertise, which you find amongst very junior Foreign Service officers, incredibly gifted young people that could be doing anything with their lives, could be paid much more if they work for the private sector, but decided they wanted to serve their country, who look at this and say, my gosh, maybe I made a mistake, maybe this is not what I want to do, and to choose to leave earlier for what they believe to be greener pastures. And in the middle, what you find are a lot of mid-grade officers, 10, 12, 15 years of service, who look ahead of them and see how poorly their seniors are treated, look behind them and see so many younger people moving on, and have to evaluate from themselves whether or not it's worth essentially leaving now in the sort of the middle of their careers, or finding ways to just make do or go to other parts of the department where they may be less visible and therefore less prone to invoke the ire of an increasing politicized leadership.
Ambassador, you mentioned junior Foreign Service officers here who may be watching this and being dissuaded by what's happening. But I want to talk a little bit also about the effect that all of this has on foreign policy and the importance here, particularly in these roles, the diplomacy roles of experience. I think there are probably folks who have very romanticized views of what diplomats do. But can you talk about the role of actual tangible experience and how important that is for State Department, particularly senior State Department employees?
Absolutely. I mean, so first of all, when most Americans see diplomacy of foreign policy, what they most in cases are seeing are, you know, the big major summits when the president goes somewhere, or big treaties, or maybe big negotiations as it relates to armed conflict or other sorts of things. And those clearly, obviously, are very, very important. And our professional diplomatic corps brings an awful lot of expertise to that. But what the vast majority of what they are doing are things that most of the American public will never see. Most don't know about, and nevertheless are very important to our interests. So whether that is understanding the nature of political dynamics in Azerbaijan or in Jordan, or trying to understand the nature of tribal relationships in the Mandera Triangle in between Kenya, Tanzania, and Ethiopia, or whether that is trying to understand the dynamics between rival gangs in El Salvador or Honduras, and how the respective governments are dealing with this, and having not only historical background but the language capabilities and the relationships to be able to try to convince foreign interlocutors to take actions which are not only in their interest, but also in our interest as well. You know, the essence of diplomacy is to get someone else to do something that you want them to do because they want to do it. And the vast majority of American power comes down to that, not to the aircraft carriers or to the submarines or infantry battalions that our valiant military serves, but to that level of negotiation and persuasion and understanding of local knowledge that simply does not happen overnight, that you can't just pull down off the internet, and that you can't deploy without years of both expertise and trust building on the ground. And that's what America's professional diplomatic corps, what our professional foreign service does for the American people every day all around the world. We are making judgments, calculations about what is in our national interest vis-a-vis the other side, and then trying to extract concessions from the other side based on what is in the national interest. We never, ever make those calculations on the basis of what is in the personal political interest of the President of the United States or anybody else. And that is what happened with regard to the withhold of vitally needed arms to the Ukraine, which is engaged in a hot war with Russia, in exchange for an investigation to try to find political dirt on the president's most feared political rival for his reelection.
Ambassador, we've talked on this show in particular about how President Trump's sort of erratic approach in many ways to foreign policy has weakened in some ways the United States' standing on the world stage. Do you see what's happening at the State Department as having a similar effect, particularly with all of what you just laid out, with people who have this level of expertise? And how our foreign allies and or non-allies might be viewing us? Are we seen as weaker with all of this happening?
There's no question that we are, because when American diplomats, whether our ambassadors or our junior officers at post or our more senior assistant secretaries or even the Secretary of State himself, when they speak to foreign interlocutors, those interlocutors have to know that they're speaking for the policy of the United States and in some cases directly for the President of the United States. And the way in which President Trump has decided to conduct himself means that the whole world knows that nobody speaks for American policy or for the president, other than the president himself, and sometimes just by tweet. And as we've seen with the abandonment, the shameless abandonment of our allies, the Kurds in northern Syria, as a result of a phone call between President Erdogan and Turkey and President Trump, this has disastrous consequences. I mean, not only will the abandonment go down as the greatest betrayal of a battlefield ally in American history, every other country, every other armed group, every other intelligence asset, everybody else around the world with whom the United States has vital partnerships is looking at that incident and wondering whether or not the United States will be able to keep its word, whether or not we are worthy to be trusted. And that will have implications for whether or not partners decide to back us in wars. It will have implications for whether or not partners decide to share vitally important secret information with us, sometimes at great peril with themselves. It will have dramatically bad consequences for whether or not countries decide that if they sign a treaty with us, that we will honor it in good faith, which is not to say that there aren't serious policy questions around all these things, about whether and what our disposition ought to be in the Middle East, how we ought to fight ISIS, what the distribution and deployment of our military forces around the world ought to be. Of course there are, but you don't make those kinds of major decisions on a whim by a phone call or by tweet without consultation, without understanding, because when you do, you place a dagger through the essential element of diplomacy, which is trust. And as one of my mentors once told me, you cannot surge trust. You have to build it before you need it. And if you are cavalier with it and you destroy it so quickly, it can be years, if ever, before it is built up again.
Ambassador Reuben E. Brigady, Dean at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University and former U.S. Representative to the African Union, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Joining me now is Nahal Tusi, a foreign affairs reporter for Politico. Thanks for being with us, Nahal.
Thanks for having me.
So since Donald Trump took office, we've heard about many things, including the quote-unquote deep state that he believes is against him. What effect has that had, Nahal, on how intelligence agencies have been treated during his administration?
Well, he seems to very much not trust the intelligence agencies, as well as the State Department and other pieces of the executive branch because he just isn't sure that they are loyal to him. You have intelligence agencies, diplomats, and others who feel like they have targets on their back. They're just trying to do their job. They have an oath that they take that means that they're supposed to act in a nonpartisan way and offer the best advice that they can to the president. But when they offer him an analysis or advice that basically goes against what he wants to believe, even if it's true, that just basically means he becomes more suspicious of them to begin with.
We're seeing, as you know, and as many Americans are watching, lots of folks from within the State Department and diplomats making decisions to testify before Congress in spite of White House opposition. What are people inside the State Department thinking about that?
Well, they feel pretty good about the fact that you have these diplomats who are defying orders from the White House, defying orders from the Secretary of State, and going to Congress and testifying and telling members of Congress how they feel about the way that diplomats have been treated over the past 3 years and what the concerns that they have about how this is going to affect U.S. foreign policy going forward. There's a lot of folks in the State Department who, for the past 3 years, have really felt marginalized and frustrated. And, you know, they just feel like this is a moment of, I use the word revenge in my story, but I got some blowback from them. So, you know, they feel it's a moment of justice. Let's put it that way.
And these are concerns. I mean, obviously, especially when we're talking about senior State Department officials and people who've worked under multiple administrations, these are bipartisan concerns. They're not political in nature, are they?
Well, look, when you have civil service officers and foreign service officers who work in the government, they serve under whoever is president, Republican or Democrat. Some serve for decades. And the whole idea is they are nonpartisan and they're there to offer continuity and expertise to whoever takes charge of the White House. But these people have been accused of being Obama holdovers by Trump political appointees, even if they have been in government long before President Barack Obama took office. And so they've been tagged in this way. And it's like the Trump aides and President Trump himself feels like they're disloyal simply because they were there before Trump won the presidency. But the idea that you can, you know, replace hundreds of thousands, millions of government workers just when you take office, it's not realistic, right? So you need a civil and foreign service that's there that offers the backbone of what government does that keeps things functioning and continuing, even, you know, between presidents.
Well, and to that end, I mean, we saw the former and ousted ambassador to Ukraine, Yovanovitch, had served for decades in her role and with the State Department. So the Trump administration has been pretty open about pushing back against whistleblowers and any kind of dissent. Is silencing civil servants, is this silencing them, or are they finding ways to express themselves? We heard from our previous guests that there's sort of an informal, you know, channel of conversation happening in Foggy Bottom over there. But are you seeing other things?
Well, sure. I mean, they talk amongst themselves. They go on, you know, special encrypted apps at the National Security Council, you know, especially in the early days of Trump. I mean, they definitely found ways to huddle. But basically, it was because they were extremely worried about some of the things that the Trump administration wanted to do, because, A, they feel like it was probably illegal. And there were just all sorts of concerns. But you have to remember, look, if there was seriously a deep state in this country, and I used to work in Pakistan, where, you know, I think there arguably is a deep state, it would be a lot more powerful, you know, but they have not really been able to do anything to change this administration in a way that's tangible. So some of them, when you mention the idea of a deep state, they laugh at you. They're like, what are you talking about? We are not that potent. And we're just trying to make sure that whatever policy this administration puts in place, that it's legal, that it's workable, that it's logistically capable of being put into place to begin with.
We talked a little bit about State Department watching as diplomats are testifying before Congress. What are the risks of testifying there? What are the risks that they face for opposing the White House in that way?
Well, they raise the risk of Trump having even more disdain and distrust of the State Department. Even if the president is impeached, he is unlikely to be removed from office, and there's still a strong chance that he'll get reelected. So you already have a State Department that has tensions with the White House, and now that they're testifying against the president in a way, it's just going to risk his wrath further. And then that leads to another risk, which is this whole idea that already people around the world are confused about who speaks for U.S. foreign policy, what U.S. foreign policy actually is, because it's so chaotic and confused and divergent at certain points. And this is going to add to that. If a U.S. diplomat is out there on the front lines talking to his counterpart from another country, they're going to ask this person, look, how do I know that you're really speaking for the president?
And when we think about leadership over at the State Department, our previous guest mentioned Rex Tillerson and Mike Pompeo. When he came in, he was seen as a welcome change from Tillerson. He was supposed to improve morale. That seems to have changed. And I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of when that happened.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, in August, the Inspector General of the State Department put out a report that talked about the very bad way in which a lot of career employees had been treated in the International Organizations Bureau of the State Department. And Pompeo did nothing to remove, he did not fire the head of that bureau, who's a political appointee. And Pompeo's aides said that he couldn't because the man was a Senate-confirmed appointee. But that meant that people in this bureau who had been abused, and this is something the Inspector General confirmed by this leader of this bureau, were livid because they were like, wait a minute, like, you're not going to do anything to fire him? You're not going to get rid of him? So that was one thing. And then you have the Yovanovitch case where, you know, Secretary Pompeo was on that call. Secretary Pompeo was the one who basically said, fine, let's pull Marie Yovanovitch out of Ukraine. And he has never publicly defended her. And that drives people crazy. Like, even if he felt like behind the scenes he was protecting Yovanovitch by getting her out of there, she's still on the State Department payroll. She wasn't fired. Even if he felt like he was helping her, the fact that he will not say anything positive about her in public, it just drives people crazy. And it's clear that he's doing that because he wants to make sure not to make Donald Trump mad at him.
Nahal Tusi is a foreign affairs reporter for Politico. Nahal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hey, parents, if your teenager won't stop complaining about waking up early for school, you might want to consider moving to California. California recently became the first state to mandate later start times for most middle and high schools. By the beginning of the 2022 school year, public middle schools will begin classes at 8 a.m. or later, and high schools will not start earlier than 8:30. The move could be a significant one for students in the state. Research shows that extra sleep for adolescent students can actually benefit their academic performance and their physical health. So I talked to Judy Owens, the director of sleep medicine at Boston Children's Hospital and a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. And she told me exactly how much sleep teenagers need and how much they're actually getting.
In terms of the recommendations, and these are from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine in 2016, teenagers, which include middle and high school students, should be getting between 8.5 and 10 hours of sleep. But we know that the vast majority of tweens and teens are not getting nearly that much sleep. And in fact, some of them may actually be getting closer to 5 or 6 hours of sleep.
And do we know why that is? I mean, is it that adolescents have different sleep cycles than adults do or than younger kids?
So what happens at around the time of pubertal onset, there is a natural normal shift in circadian rhythms. That's essentially our brain's time clock, which determines, among other things, when we fall asleep and when we wake up. Most teenagers cannot fall asleep much before 11 o'clock at night. And if they're getting the sufficient amount of sleep that they need, that means they're programmed to wake up at around 8 o'clock in the morning. So a move to 8:30 represents a very significant increased sleep opportunity. And it's not only more sleep that these students will get, but the timing of their sleep will be more appropriate to their circadian rhythms. And that may be equally, if not more important than how much sleep they get, it's when they sleep as well.
So most kids, I'm going to, as we just said, are not getting that. And what effect does that have on students in school?
Well, we certainly know that insufficient sleep is linked to poor academic performance, lower performance on standardized tests, and also other issues related to school success, like being more likely to be tardy, more likely to be absent, and even less likely to graduate from high school. But this goes far beyond improvements in academic performance. We know that insufficient and mistimed sleep has profound effects on health and safety. So, for example, students who do not get enough sleep are more likely to be depressed and more likely to express suicidal thoughts. And, you know, of course, suicide, unfortunately, is the third highest cause of death among adolescents. We also know that motor vehicle accidents are increased when students don't get enough sleep, and accidental injuries are the number one cause of mortality among adolescents in the U.S. So this has profound implications for very important public health issues in adolescents.
Is there any indication that this is also or should start happening for students who are younger, say elementary school students? Is the idea ultimately just to get all students on the same late start? Would that make sense for younger students as well?
Now, in terms of younger children, in contrast to adolescents, they are much more likely to be what we call morning larks, or to have a tendency to go to bed earlier and wake up earlier. It makes much more sense for the younger children to be going to school earlier than it is to have the high school students have that early start time.
Judith Owens is the director of sleep medicine at Boston Children's Hospital, a professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School, and was the lead author of the 2014 American Academy of Pediatrics Policy Statement on Later School Start Times. Judy, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Kyla Wahlstrom is a senior research fellow at the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. Kyla, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So, I'm not a teenager, but I'm up early and I'm pretty tired. What are the average school start times throughout the country right now?
The average starting time in about 87% of all high schools in the U.S. is earlier than 8:30. So that means that we have teens that are getting up very early, before 7 often, or 6:30, 6 o'clock, if the schools are starting at 7, 7:15. It's an early time for them.
And how many districts around the country, or, you know, if you can give us an estimate of percentages of school districts around the country that are starting to change to later start times around 8 or 8:30?
It's interesting because this has been going on actually for 23 years. And I would say that after the first initial start time changes happened in Edina, Minnesota, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, and then the Minneapolis Public Schools made their time change in 1997, I'm just guesstimating, but I would guess there's more than 1,000 school districts across the country that have made that change independently after having the research brought to their attention.
We've interviewed someone who was part of a 2014 study on this and was touting sort of the benefits to young people for having later school start times. But what about parents? I mean, this is something that parents obviously have to adjust to. Have you heard anything from them as far as how they are dealing with the later school start times?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting, for all the research that I've done over 23 years, we've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of parents in focus groups, individual interviews, and so on. And parents are saying that, first off, they're very concerned about their child having to be up so early and that they struggle to get the kids out of bed. So with the later starting time, there's been a real remarkable change for how parents are seeing their children and their ability to get them up in the morning. And as a result, 92% of the parents that I've interviewed or surveyed have said their kids are easier to live with. Now, that said, this kind of change that California is going to embark on is really going to challenge parents' schedules, their work schedules, home life schedules, and so on. But over the years, as we have investigated this, we have found families have really made the adjustments quite well. But it takes about a year for everything, all of the school schedules, the holidays, the work schedules, vacations, and so on, have to be adjusted.
Now, what type of families are we talking about here? I mean, are low-income families affected differently than other families are when it comes to making those types of adjustments, whether it's the daycare or just general family structure?
Yes, actually, there is some difference among the family constellations and the family economic situations. One of the things that has been really important, actually, in the findings that we have seen over the years is that in low-income areas where there are not, say, two parents in the family or there's not a car, if the student were to miss the bus or to sleep through their alarm, there's been no way for the parents to get the child to school. So actually, low-income families have found, and low-income students, we have found that there's better attendance because these students are not struggling to get out of bed and missing the first hour or even the whole day of school.
Now, in terms of California, which is the latest state to put this into place, what hurdles will they face when it comes to real-life practical implementation on the state level?
Well, on the state level, it's going to be interesting to see what the state does to assist and enable school districts to make this change. There's going to be a wide variety of solutions that the school districts are going to begin to think about. And over the years, as I've looked at this, there's been a need to look at adjusting bus schedules and adjusting when childcare is available in the school district before and after school. Whether or not the child care is available on a free and reduced sliding fee scale. And there'll be other adjustments that the state will have to look at, because the thing that's nice about the California change is that all of the districts are going to be on the same wavelength, if you will, by 2022. One of the problems that we have found over the years is as athletic schedules and other issues that have to do with sports and clubs and things that kids do after school, when the districts are not in sync for when their starting and ending times are, they have a difficulty staying within the sports schedules and the club schedules. And this will allow all of the districts across the state to have some similarity in terms of when they dismiss their students.
Kyla, do you expect more states to follow California? Are there any pockets of, shall we say, resistance to this that you've noticed?
Regarding the first question, I do believe that other states will take courage by making this change to go forward. This is a very controversial decision in some localities, and it's because people don't like change, and there's a rhythm to a community when the buses come and go, when the kids go off to school, if it's elementary, middle school, or high school, and when the parents go to work or drop their kids off. This will create some stress, certainly, on the part of the regularities of the community. Now, California is leading the way, and this may give courage to some districts and states to make this change and be similar to what California is doing. That said, I am well aware of many districts that have had this discussion, and if the school board is polarized and doesn't agree with the idea, then there often has been even a superintendent losing his or her job as a result of supporting or initiating this kind of change.
Kyla Wahlstrom is a senior research fellow at the College of Education and Human Development at the University of Minnesota. Kyla, thank you.
You're most welcome.
The 1970s were an iconic era for Black filmmaking. Movies like Shaft and Foxy Brown presented bold characters that connected with audiences rarely given an opportunity to see themselves represented on screen. While many of these films are now referred to as Blaxploitation movies, some fans take issue with the label.
As a person of color, we didn't view that era to be exploitive at all. If anything, it was like a resurgence, or not even a resurgence, a birth of entertainment that was done by us, for us.
That's actress Davine Joy Randolph in her latest film, Dolomite Is My Name, tells the true story of Rudy Ray Moore, a comedian who self-financed a series of provocative movies in the 1970s. Many of those films starred an actress named Lady Reed, who Davine plays in the film, alongside Eddie Murphy as Moore.
You've been up on stage, Lady Reed.
I used to be a backup singer in New Orleans.
I knew it. I told you.
You sure do.
The singer, huh?
I get so nervous I had to hang on to the mic from not falling over. Butterflies all in my stomach.
You're funny. You should be doing stand-up.
But what would I do?
Ahead of the film's release this Friday on Netflix, I sat down in the studio with Davine, and she told me that preparing to play Lady Reed was unexpectedly complicated.
I immediately started to try to, you know, dig in because it wasn't within my realm of awareness. And if you Google her, there's little to no information. And at first I thought, you know, well, maybe I'm not really looking well enough. And at school, no matter what project you did, what play you did, you were connected with a dramaturgy major. So that's basically like an art historian. And they basically collect a whole bunch of information and artifacts that all would be pertained to the subject matter of the role you're doing or the play that you're doing. It doesn't have to be period piece, just they're like an encyclopedia, literally, of your project. So I got spoiled, and I thought that that's what the real world was. That's you always have this person by you. And so that wasn't the case. But I immediately called one of my classmates and was like, okay, I'm not seeing anything, but maybe, you know, with your skill set, you can really dig. And they couldn't find anything. And that's just really heartbreaking, you know? And I don't really know the reason as to why that is, and that's kind of put me on this path of an exploratory journey of even more people of color that we don't know about, and especially women of color. With that all being said, my resources were limited yet powerful. And so it was her movies, and then it was her party albums, which is basically like, you know, stand-up recorded on vinyl. And so her voice was my biggest way in.
In the 1975 movie Dolemite, Lady Reed played Queen Bee, but all the other women were credited as Dolemite girls.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Does that like...
Well, I can't lie. As the actor, I'm like, yes, I was the woman who had a name. You know what I mean? But it is. It's tricky because, you know, for sure, at that time, that was a thing where I think just as a society as a whole, that's where women were just... Right. So we're coming out of like sexual repression and conformity from the 50s. And then 60s is like we're just trying everything. And then 70s is in this new space of like trying to figure it out of like, OK, I may not want to go all the way to the left that I just came from the 60s. And so but men were like, no. I still want you to be over there. You know what I mean? Like, and so then women are really gaining their voices in a way. So it is disheartening of like, so she can't have a name, you know what I mean? Or her purpose is just to be an ownership to you. It's disheartening. I will say on the flip side, in doing this movie and being the only female, obviously coming into it, I was like, I don't know what to expect. You know, on top of these guys being legends within their own right and fully established careers, iconic careers in their own way, I really didn't know what I was going to walk into, you know, being literally in a world of all men, you know. And besides, like, you know, the hair and makeup trailer and costumes, everyone else on set is men. They exceeded my expectation and super generous and kind and supportive. And even with the writers, what was so lovely is that they allowed me just to be a woman.
So I'm wondering what your thoughts are specifically on the fact that this movie, even though it's telling an important part of Black cultural history, was written by two white men and directed by another.
I'm gonna be honest. When I received this, everything was like untitled, unscripted. It was all very mum's the word. So I didn't know who the writers were. The only thing I knew was that Craig Brewer, who directed Hustle and Flow, and we had worked on a couple of episodes for the fourth season of Empire, was directing it. And it was the breakdown that took my breath away. And, you know, I don't know if people know, but breakdowns is like a quick, crass, soundbite description of the character you're playing. And I don't know if it's sometimes more so meant for, like, just your agent or manager's eyes to see, because as an actor, when you see it, at least in my experience, it's not that hopeful. You know what I mean? It's like funny, fat black woman. And you're just like, whoa, you know what I mean? Or like dowdy black woman who can't get a man because she's fat. And you're just like, who wants to do this? You know what I mean? And they're not all like that, but most are like that, you know? And so I've always found my personal challenge is I'm going to turn this into a human being and I'm going to tell this lady's story.
Are we at a place that you think that Hollywood is allowing more black actors like yourself to be more human about the characters that they play, to be less, you know, stereotypical in that whole, particularly when you said, you know, when you describe black women, roles for black women, you know, sassy, angry, sad, single, all these like stereotypes. Like, are we starting to turn the corner or is there more to do in your opinion?
There's obviously a ton more to do. I do think with these movements of like, you know, plus size inclusivity and when you're having the transgender awareness, because of what the world is, I feel like there's a demand and a call to order for things to catch up, but it has a long way to catch up. So for me, that is a huge part of my journey in these roles that I take. You know what I mean? It is important because it's not that much out there for us, that the roles that I do, whether I am playing a prison inmate or not, I make the choice no matter who I play, even if I'm a trash collector, that as a person of color, I am the best at this job. You know what I mean? Like, I played a secretary once. I can type so fast. Like, I set myself up to win no matter what the job is. And I think when you do that, that's why people are allowed to see and are able to see, I hope, a fuller and more enriching character that I bring to the forefront, because I'm not going to give you a stereotype.
Davine Joy Randolph is one of the stars of Dolemite Is My Name. Davine, thank you for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that's our show for today. Of course, you can always give us a call about anything you heard on the show at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.